This is Jim Turton, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee at the Bass Club reunion in Cardiff on the 12th of June 2010. Jim Turton.
Well, I'm James Turton, otherwise known as Jim, to all my friends. I was born in Bristol, and that was on the 3rd of August 1951.
And what was your first brush with the Antarctic?
Oh, well, that's rather interesting because in my school holidays, I used to work in a boatyard in the village I lived in, well, still live in. And
which is what?
Littleton upon Severn. A little village on the banks of the River Severn. And working in this boatyard, I worked alongside a carpenter, and we were building this wonderful, great big 52-foot trimaran, which was being built in the boatyard. And I was just, because I was good at carpentry at school, that's what I went along to help with my school holidays. And I sort of heard nothing more about this bloke after I'd left. And many years later, 1973, I think, I went to a pub which I don't normally go to in the local town. And I bumped into this bloke, and he never normally goes to this pub either. And his name was Jack Temple. And I said, "Hello, Jack, nice to see you." "Yes, nice to see you. What have you been up to?" And he said he'd just come back from the Antarctic. I said, "Oh, that sounds very interesting." He said, yeah, tell me all a little bit about it. And I said, "Oh, I'm sort of looking for a change of career," because I was in the aircraft industry at the time. And I said, "Give me the address." So he gave me the address of Bass, and I sort of sent a letter off to them, said, "This is me, and this is what I do, and what you're doing sounds interesting, you know." And they wrote a very nice letter back and said, "Yeah, well, yeah, we'd like to speak to you, and you know, you can apply for any one of three posts, really, a meteorologist or a diesel mechanic or an ionosphericist, and we take it from there." Well, I knew what the first two were. I knew what a meteorologist and a diesel mechanic were. I didn't have a clue what an ionosphericist was. Well, I said I didn't have a clue, I had a guess. So I applied for that one. So I applied for the ionosphericist. I went up to London, and they offered me a job there and then. So,
well, for those of us who don't have a clue what ionospherics are...
Right, ionospherics is the study of the ionospheric layer, which was obviously known as the Heaviside layer at one time, which is the area of the upper atmosphere where radio waves are propagated. And they back in the days of early shortwave radio and medium wave radio, of course, you probably noticed you got reception better at night than you did during the day, and that's because of the effects of the ionosphere. It attenuates, at a lower level, it attenuates the radio waves as they go up, and at a higher level, it reflects them back down again. And so at night, the attenuation layer, which is driven by the sun, effectively the E layer, driven by the sun, effectively disappears, and so you get much better propagation of radio waves at night than during the day. So all the kids like I was listening to Radio Luxembourg under their blankets at night so the parents didn't hear benefited from the ionosphere. And of course the at the poles, the ionosphere is particularly interesting because of solar terrestrial physics. It's where the magnetic field curves in towards the Earth, and therefore it the solar wind and the solar electrons, which, you know, emitted from the sun all the time, they spiral down the field lines and into the lower layers of the ionosphere, and it means the poles are a particularly interesting place to study it.
Coming from Bristol, you didn't know Horace Batchelor, I presume?
No, but I know he came from Keynsham, yes. Spelled K-E-Y-N-S-H-A-M. Yes, Keynsham, okay. Bristol, yeah. Yes.
Well, okay, but you didn't know that then, so what on earth made you feel you could apply to FIDS as a Bass in your case with this speciality?
Well, my hobby ever since I can remember was playing with radios, and electronics was always my passion, really. And right from school, you know, we used to build little radio receivers and illegal transmitters, and so yeah, we did use the ionosphere to an extent. I ran a for a short while a pirate radio station from the attic of my house and was picked up as far away as the other side of Bristol once with only two records, I seem to remember. Go Now and Little Red Rooster, I think, was only the I used to take it in turns to be top of the hit parade every week. But yeah, it was a passion, radios, and me and my friends, we used to go around to all the rubbish tips in the area, and pick up all the old television sets and radio sets that people had thrown onto them, take them home, take them to bits, take all the bits out and remodel them to make our own radios and things. And you learn a hell of a lot doing that. It's just a passion, really, you know.
Well, these are lines you were spinning at the interview for Bass.
I can't remember what I spun that line, but... no, I can't remember. Funnily enough, only last week I went to a dinner with some Arnus Ferric friends. We've kept this dining club going for years called Tidsop. It's another story, but... and the bloke who interviewed me pulled out the interview notes for all of us that were there. There was nothing about rubbish tips in it, but there were some interesting revelations, shall we say, in the interview.
Whatever it was, you said it worked.
It worked, yes. Well, I knew it worked because after the interview, they said, I'll go along to the admin office and put your expenses in or whatever it was for the trip up. And I did that. And they said, oh, you've been asked to go for a medical. And the girl, I think it was Margaret Clark, who was there at the time, said, that means you've probably got the job. And so I went to have the medical, which was, again, another experience. I expect many people to tell you about the medicals they have with Surgeon Colonel Hayward. That was it, really.
Rigorous medical or not?
Yes, it was... I would say as a physical medical, it wasn't terribly rigorous. As a psychological medical, it probably was. You know, they ask you all sorts of questions, which I suppose you have to give the right answer to. You know, what are you like when you're drunk and all these sort of things. And they're trying to find out whether you're the right sort of character to spend sort of 2 years locked up with people of a similar sort of insanity, I suppose. And, but yeah, physically, obviously, they check all the normal things. But they're looking as much for someone who can adapt and live in that and be tolerant in that sort of environment, which is a difficult environment to be in.
In the gap between being appointed and heading south, what sort of training did you have to do?
Right, we obviously had to learn a little bit about the ionosphere, or quite a lot about the ionosphere, really, as a scientific subject. And so we went to the Radio Space Research Station, which was latterly the Appleton Laboratory at Slough. There they had an ionosonde, which was the same as the piece of equipment we were going to be working on down there, which even then, in the 1970s, was extremely old hat. You know, it was all valves and bicycle chains, a fascinating piece of equipment, actually. Very well designed. So we learned how that worked, because our part of the job was to maintain it. So we learned how that worked and how to keep it running, and also how to do sort of primary reduction on all the data it produced. And so the job on base was to take the records the machine gave you, which was basically a piece of 35mm film with what we call an anagram on it, and reduce that information and take off all the critical frequencies and heights of the different layers, and put it and condense it into a form, you know, a tabular form, which was then sent back to UK and then on into the World Database and the World Databases. So that was the job, and that's what we did. We trained to do that.
And what happens to that information in the end? I mean, how is it useful to mankind?
How is it useful to mankind? Well, how is any information useful to mankind? The data itself goes into the world data centres, and it's there for research purposes by whoever wishes to research a particular aspect of the ionosphere or any other. You know, it's the same as MET data, same as all magnetospheric data, solar data. It's all there, and people who wish to conduct a research, maybe looking at the history, how it's changed over the last, you know, 50 years. If you've got a continuous record of data over a long period of time, you know, these clever chaps in universities can deduce an awful lot from it.
Well, we saw that happen to meteorological data about 25 years ago when the first hint of global warming started to emerge.
Well, yes, and of course that's how we discovered the ozone hole, you know, by looking at records over a long period of time. And that was, of course, done at Bath by Joe Farman and his team. You know, and just by having that fantastic record of information, which is complete and continuous, you know, and it's still going on today, you know, so very important.
Did at that time, and we're talking about 74, 70, 75, I guess.
Yeah, 74 I went down the first time, yeah.
Did you, before you went, were you given rigorous health and safety training? And
no, not in those days. No, we didn't go swinging off ropes and things in those days. I think it more so now. And we did our training for things like crevasse rescue and all that sort of thing on the boat on the way down. And that was sort of basically one of the GAs who was going down showing us the techniques. In a way, it wasn't necessary for people like myself because we were working on a static base. You know, we weren't going out into the field and crossing massive glacier-strewn parts of the inland. We were you know, on a static base on an island. Yes, we did travel, but we always travelled, hopefully in controlled, you know, conditions close to base.
Nice weather, in other words.
Nice weather.
Yeah. The base you went to was Faraday. Were you told in advance where you were going to go?
Yes, but not until a week or two before we sailed. Because there's ionospheric sounder at Faraday Base, one at Halley and one on South Georgia. And obviously there wasn't just me, there was other guys going down as well at the same time. And they didn't decide who went to which base until, you know, quite late in the process. And that was also done by, you know, evaluating you, if you like.
On the boat?
No, this is before we got on the boat, we knew which base we were going to, but they knew what sort of people they wanted to go to which sort of base, really, to do the job.
Did the Antarctic live up to your expectations?
Absolutely, yeah. It exceeded them, I think, really, in terms of the environment and what it was like. It was just, I mean, I've always been an outdoor person, but yeah, it was totally mind-blowing to sort of wake up one morning in the Antarctic, you know, after having, you know, you left the Falklands, you go over the heavy seas, and then one morning you wake up and you're there, and you're just surrounded by all these wonderful mountains and glaciers and ice and snow. You've never seen anything like it before. It's quite incredible, yeah.
Were you given much chance to go and explore?
Depends what you mean by explore.
Well, sledging trips and so on.
Not from the base I was on, because it wasn't a sledging base, it was a static base, and it was just atmospheric sciences going on there, meteorology, and ionospherics and physics. Basically, it wasn't a travelling base. Later, when I went to Rothera, then on other programmes, then yes, I did get out a bit more, but not so much over land, more by air. But I certainly got around a lot. Yeah,
You didn't get very far though, because you broke your leg, didn't you?
Yes. Well, that was I broke my leg. I think it was probably late February, March, 1975, not long after I'd been there, really. I'd been down there for the summer and went skiing, and yeah, I managed to spectacularly break my leg by dropping the ski into a water channel which was covered in snow. It snowed over, and of course it broke off and broke underneath the ski in the weight, and as I was on the turn, and of course it was a rather nasty crunching sound from the bottom of my body, and that was it. So I broke my leg. The lads carried me into the base, where we had an incredibly primitive X-ray machine, which wasn't really working very well. So actually, being the electronics person on base, I had to sort of fix it before I could X-ray my own leg.
What
an
experience. Okay.
So after a bit of judicious rewiring and thinking that, well, I think you can take a picture now, you know. So we X-rayed the leg and decided it was not a very good break. It's broken in two places. I say two places, both bones, the tibia and fibula. You still see the lump. And they called up the boat because it was quite late in the season, really, and the boat was essentially heading heading up to South America, I think, for a cruise rest before they came down to a few more bases to do final relief and come home. So the crew weren't too impressed that they had to suddenly turn around from their trip to South America and pick me up, but they did. And I got on the boat, and the doctor on the boat looked at it and thought it didn't look quite right, so he broke it again and stuck me in the surgery on the swing bed. There was a sort of gimbaled bed in the surgery on the Bransfield. And we were crossing the Drake Passage, and it was this horrendous storm, and everything broke loose in the surgery. There were these bottles of oxygen on the floor of the surgery, which managed to come free from their shackles and were rolling around the surgery floor. And that was a bit alarming, because I thought, crikey, if one of the neck gets knocked off one of those, it's going to go off like a rocket. And so nobody would dare come in there. So I was in there on my own with all this happening. And then the X-ray machine, which was, you know, the ship's X-ray machine, which was very cleverly placed on a bracket above the swing bed, fell off the wall and onto me. So that broke my leg again. So that was so we had to... Eventually, when it calmed down, the doctor came in and sorted it all out. So that was the third time it got broken. And then I came all the way home, and when I got back to the hospital, the doctor took a look at me and said, "Well, that's not right. Better break that again and start from afresh." So so they broke it again, and I got broken four times altogether, really, and then got put in a proper plaster. Oh, no, a fifth time. It was five times, because we went to the Falkland Islands, and they took me to the hospital there, and the marine doctor looked at it and said, "No, that's not right, I'd better break it again." So he broke it the fourth time. Yeah, then he broke it the fifth time in Southmead Hospital in Bristol.
Didn't you protest at any point in this process?
Well, I suppose, yeah, if you've really got to break it, you go, "Oh, yeah, it won't set right," you know, so you have to believe these guys, they're supposed to know best, aren't they? Okay.
So you got back to England, and it mended?
Got it mended, yeah, it actually mended. In time for me to fly down and meet the Bransfield in Montevideo, round about Christmas 75, I suppose, just before Christmas 75.
And they returned you to Faraday?
They returned me to Faraday.
And then work could begin? And
work could begin. I carried on, I got back on the skis and tried them out. Yes, they're okay now. Work could begin. Of course, I was a year late by then. Of course, I.
So nobody had been doing the readings whilst you were absent?
Well, yes. I mean, because the way the system works is that you take over from somebody who's already there, if you know what I mean. So you work two at a time. It's just that because I came out, in fact, they put a lad in to replace me. He wasn't an arms fair, so he's a physicist, but he was a spare bod, basically. So he stood in my place while I was out. So the chap who was going to stay anyway stayed, so there were still two running the team. And I came in and carried on the programme. And it was fine. Yeah, we were okay.
You were there for, was it two winters?
Two winters.
Collecting all this material. Mm. And there were other electronic developments you were involved with?
I mean, the base has a lot of electronic equipment on it. Notably, a wind-finding radar system, which we were responsible for, which is what the meteorologists use to track a balloon. And this was quite an interesting piece of equipment, really, built by Plessy Radar on the Isle of Wight. I mean, as part of the training course, I went over there to spend a fortnight finding out how that worked properly. That was always breaking down, and we were always having to fix it. There were all sorts of problems with it, really. Most of them were because of the cold. Seems absolutely ironical, doesn't it? But the system wasn't designed to be worked in the Antarctic, basically, but they adapted the cabling, which had to go from the hut out to the tower where the actual radome was, had to have heating tapes all around it to keep the cables warm, because otherwise they just fracture in the cold with a slight bit of movement. And it was never very satisfactory. And so we were always having problems with cable failures. But yeah, we kept it going.
You said you were the early electronics man on the base, is that right?
Yeah, at that time, yeah.
So everything else was your responsibility too?
Pretty much, yeah. When anything broke down, I was the first person anyone to come to, yeah, for it to be fixed. The only other guy who had... Well, and they weren't really electronics engineers, it was the radio operators, because they were operators, they weren't really that electronically. They were okay, but they didn't have the background, really.
So being the electronics guy on the base was far from being a cushy number then?
Yeah, it was all right when things were working. It also meant you were the butt end of all the problems. You know, I mean, the equipment I worked on, the ionosonde, was always known as the Beast. And it was called the Beast partly because it interfered with every other piece of equipment on base because it was a very high power transmitter. A bit like when your mobile phone goes off, it interferes with every radio that's going around, isn't it? This is the same sort of thing. And of course, it did a sounding every quarter of an hour. So nobody could listen to a record in peace, you know, because every time you put a record on every quarter of an hour, this thing would come breaking through and ruin it. So that was the interesting challenge, is finding out how to keep this machine out. Yeah, so you learn quite a lot about, you know, keeping radio frequency out of audio equipment, yeah. So that was quite good fun doing some of that.
There were one or two unhappy events at Faraday whilst you were there.
Yeah, well...
A couple of incidents which perhaps we ought to talk about, even though they're not necessarily
moments. Sure, absolutely, yeah.
And there were three base members who were lost during 76. There was an accident of some sort.
Yeah, they went off on a climbing expedition, essentially.
Do you remember, who were they?
There was the cook, whose name was Mike. There was a meteorologist, whose name was Jeff. And there was a physicist whose name was Graham. And they were all very well qualified to do what they were going to do. They were all good, experienced mountaineers. Not professional mountaineers, but they were, you know, they had all been at university mountain club. They'd all done appropriate alpine type climbing and things. So there was no worry about them going off and doing this sort of trip. And they set off in ideal conditions to do it. You know, everything was perfect, really. They climbed the mountain. They did climb the mountain. They got to the top, and we spoke to them on the top. And they began the descent, and we never really heard from them again. Looking at the meteorological records, there was a lot of warming at that level not long after they began their descent. And they got avalanched, basically. I think that's the only conclusion that anyone can draw. We sent over, after they missed their first radio scan, and because we had regular schedules, they missed the first one. Well, that could be anything, you know. They missed the second one, and then you start to think, and then you have to act. But because the weather had started warm, it was obviously travel on the sea ice starts to become difficult or tricky, because you don't know whether the wind's going to blow all the sea ice out or not. Anyhow, but things weren't too bad still at low level. So we dispatched a party of another three guys, which didn't leave many of us on base. Three, in fact. Five. To go and have a look, basically. And they got to their base camp, the lads' base camp, and had obviously no one had been there. But they said that they started to go a bit further, and there was this huge collapsed serax, and there was just a huge amount of avalanche, obviously, on the mountain. There's just no way that they could safely go any further. And because the sea ice, because it was warming, the sea ice was beginning to retreat. You know, we had to pull them back and say, that's it, come back. Yeah. Otherwise, we're six base members down. Yeah. So that was the safe choice, the right choice. Mm-hmm. When the lads first went missing, we got support from the Argentines with an aircraft, who flew down, picked up our bass member is from Rotherham and flew there. Well, Rotherham, maybe an Adelaide Island at the time. It was Adelaide Island then. And they flew up back over the mountain, Mount Peary, and to see what was going on, really. And again, they reported severe avalanching there. So that was it, really. What can you do?
Was this a research trip or a...
No, job? Recreational trip.
Recreational trip.
Completely recreational, yeah. Yeah.
So it was just one of those things?
One of those things. And no. And recreational trips were allowed and they were approved. And you know, if we were going to have a recreational trip like that, we'd notify headquarters at London it was, I think, in those days, before it moved to Cambridge. And they'd either be approved or not approved. And if it was an approved, you know, it was fine.
What level of impact did that have back at base, the accident?
Well, quite a big impact, because it's not wrong to say there were good aspects to it. Only the positive aspects out of it were that we all learned to cook because we had to, but it became quite competitive. But no, base dynamics were quite difficult for a while. I mean, nobody apportioned any blame to anybody, but there were obviously feelings going around that maybe, you know, somebody could have done something better than they did at the time, and that some of those things left a nasty atmosphere. I wouldn't name names or anything like that, but it was hard. And one of the things, because it was in the middle of the winter, there's still a long time before relief began, and the base were more aggrieved by the fact that it seemed that when the ships came back down, they didn't give us priority. Like they went wherever. We felt that we needed a relief now, you know, not waiting for them to go off to other bases first, you know. And there was a bit of bad feeling about that towards the organisation, I think. But we just had to muscle down and get on with it. You know, people had... Yeah, had tears and and lots of talk, obviously, about things. But we still functioned as a base, and we still kept the science going, and we still had a job to do, and we got on with it. Really,
there was no attempt to find them, I suppose.
No attempt to find them, because the conditions were so bad. It wasn't. Yeah, you're putting a lot of other people's lives at risk. It's not. Not a sensible thing to do, really.
Was there any kind of ceremony back up to?
Yes, there were. Well, the ceremony happened when the Bransfield came down later in the season, and they brought down a wooden cross which Big R Smith had made, and we all went over and erected it, and which was nice that we all wanted to do that. The whole base did that, yeah. Except one member who preferred not to, and I think he rather would stay on base as a fire watch, and as a someone on base. He didn't come across, but everybody else did, and that was a very solemn thing. That was quite hard. That was because it was then final, definite, you know, and just being at that spot, you know, because we were at the place where they would have set off from, you know, that was quite hard. But yeah,
you had to strike the base camp, I guess, and bring it all back.
No, that was just left.
Was it?
Yeah, no, because that was further up in the mountain. I think that was just all abandoned to its fate. We didn't even go and try. I mean, the original party that went up there, our search party, obviously didn't have the capacity to bring back basically what was extra rubbish that they had to carry all the way back to base. So they had to get back. That was important, to get them back safely. So.
Whilst we're in this subject, there's a later on in your time, in the 1979-80 season, there was another fatality.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to tell me about that, please?
Well, that was quite hard. That was when I was doing the aeromagnetic programme, and we were flying survey lines from Rotherham. We went out and we went... went down to Druznia, which is the Russian base, and then on to Halley. And it's when we got to Halley that the aircraft did a low pass over the base, it was customary thing for when an aircraft turned up at a base was to do what we call beat up the base. In other words, fly low and fly around and do a bit of this and then land. And it was just the pilots having a bit of a fun with the planes and showing off to the base a bit, and the base enjoyed it, you know, to see the airplanes doing this sort of thing. So we did a low pass over the base. Now, Halley's a subterranean base, but there are cabooses on top, on the surface. And we did a low pass over the caboose, came around to do another one, but in the meantime, a couple of lads had jumped on top of the caboose. And, well, to this day, no one really knows exactly what happened, but the plane came over too low, basically. Or didn't take into account the fact that there were two people on top of the caboose at the time. Well, that's how close it was. And my lad's neck got broken basically by the aircraft ski.
This is chap of Miles Mosley.
Yeah. And yes, that was hard. That was very hard. Not a nice way to arrive at a base.
No.
And
so you were flying in at that point to the base.
Yeah. And you can't really apportion blame to anybody for that. I mean, everybody's got a lot of feelings about really what happened there, but it's not a really good place to. I don't think it's a good idea to say now what my particular feelings about why it happened are.
Okay. There would have been some sort of inquiry afterwards.
There was, yes.
Did you have to go to it?
No, and I was quite surprised at that. It was, yeah. I don't know who was interviewed apart from the pilot. I know I wasn't.
Was anybody sacked?
No.
Right. And were you at the base then for some time?
We were there for another good couple of weeks.
Yeah. So again, you were able to witness how the base reacted to that.
Yeah, we were there, and we were there for the committal, which was done over the ice edge, under the sea. Mm. And that was very, very difficult. Very difficult. And we flew away again. And it was very hard. That was very hard. And it wasn't very comfortable flying in the aircraft after that. Mainly because I was concerned about the psychological state of the pilot.
Nevertheless, it says here, I view my time at Bass as some of the best of my life.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, you ask any ex-serviceman what's the best time of their life, you know, even though they've been out to war and, you know, they've witnessed horrific things, it's still, to them, some of the best times of their life.
That's the most vital part of their life. Was the Antarctic the most vital?
Vital?
In terms of vitality?
Yes, I think so, yeah. It's certainly the most stimulating in many ways, really. Physically stimulating, emotionally stimulating, yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to
happier times.
Yes, on to other matters. But thank you for spending some time.
No, that's okay. No,
it's good to mark these things, really. Whilst you were with Bass, was a heck of a revolution in IT, wasn't there, really? I mean, it seemed to have leapt forward a huge amount in that time.
Yeah.
And you were involved in the developing what you call the infamous Bass Micro.
Yeah, it was
never
infamous.
Heard of. What on earth was or can be the Bass Micro?
The Bass Micro was great. Of course, computing... When I came back from the Antarctic, microprocessors really had only just sort of started to, make an impact, really. and become available to people. And Bass had got hold of, and Dick Cressman, who was the electronics engineer at the time there when it moved to Cambridge, had got basically a microprocessor home kit, which he built up and played with it and made it do various things, which was very clever and very laudable, and it worked well for what it wanted, what was wanted at the time. And I don't know whether you remember Acorn Computers, who built the famous BBC Micro. Well, they had, at that time, this is before, pre-BBC Micro, had produced something called the Acorn Atom, I think it was called, and it was a card-based system with a processor on it. And we bought one or two of these to play with. The idea was to use them mainly for automatic weather stations or base weather stations and things. And so we developed this sort of data logging system based around the Acorn. And that worked okay. And then we decided to develop our own, which was a bit more bespoke, a bit more suitable to what we wanted to do. So we built this purpose-built data logger microcomputer, really, which is a sort of rack-based system with a word processor on it and a spreadsheet on it, and all the different scientists were looking, this is good, what can we do with this, you know? And so we started a production line, essentially, of making
within
these
Bass.
Things. Within Bass, yeah. Of making these things. And at that time, I was head of the electronics laboratory then. I'd taken over from Dick, who went on to look just after the advanced ionospheric sounder system. And so I started to run the electronics lab. And we started producing these things. I don't know how many were produced, probably about 50 of the damn things, yeah. And they were, yeah, every division within Bass had, four or five Bass micros, and then they started going off to other institutes that were associated with Bass, you know, other NERC institutes were having the Bass micro, you know, which which was wonderful, and we made quite a lot of them. And
was this a source of income for Bass?
No, because it was all within the group, really. It wasn't a source of income as such, so things weren't... Well, I don't know, actually. They may have sold them to other institutes for hard cash, I don't know, but Bass, it was...
The trouble with developing or inventing and developing something is that you then have to successfully defend it and mend it, don't you?
Well, that's true, yeah, but they didn't go wrong, so we would have to mend them. They were very reliable, and it was a good piece of equipment. Yeah, it was very primitive by today's standards, but it did a very useful job, you know. It allowed scientists to collect data, log it on the equipment, and also do their word processing and whatever.
How big were they in 1980? Was it 80 or thereabouts?
Yeah, it would have been, 20 inches wide, about 6 inches tall, and about 12 inches deep, you know. Not too big,
no.
Really. But then, of course, you'd have a terminal which went with it, because which was, and there was no, it wasn't a sort of like a Windows operating system. It was all text based. We ran a program called Flex, which was an operating system, a disk operating system, really.
So, were there some people who were disbelievers?
Well, there's always disbelievers, aren't there? There's always Luddites. but most people took to it, I think. I think the scientific community there at Bass realised that it could save them an awful lot of work, you know, and make their job easier. And so we had them on board the ship for all the data logging applications on the offshore biological program stuff. And we converted it for the airborne data logging, you know. So it became quite a multi-purpose, very flexible platform.
Were they usurped in the end?
Oh, yes, they were usurped. They were usurped, actually, after I'd left Bass in 1985 I left Bass. And I guess we may have made the last one by then, but they were certainly still around and being used. But, of course, then the modern PC was beginning to make its impact, even though it had a really awful operating system. I mean, the early PCs, the Microsoft than IBM PCs, with Microsoft Disk Operating System, DOS as it was known, were actually, I think, far behind Avast Micro at the time. Yeah, until Windows operating system came out, they were far behind.
There was another piece of technology you were responsible for developing as well, which was this AeroMag engineer. No, you were an AeroMag
engineer. I was the AeroMag engineer, yeah.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, when I came back from the Antarctic, when I finished my term as atmospheric, I came back and because of my history, was in the aircraft industry. I was quite keen to get to operate with the aircraft systems, and I applied for a job as an engineer on the AeroMag program, and there was a vacancy, and that was just to sort of operate the equipment, fly operate it, and modify it to standard. I looked at it and decided that the data logging system they had in it was absolutely rubbish. Basically, you know, it was difficult to use, and it was, you never knew whether you got the data or not until you got back. And so it was a bit hit and miss, really. You could spend a whole season flying and not know whether you got any data. You didn't, so you had no way of checking whether the equipment worked. So, and that was on magnetic tape, it was recorded. There's no way you're reading it back on base. So I came up with, a modified Bass Micro type system, really, which was a complete airborne data logging system. And then they could plug all the magnetometers and all anything else into it you wanted. All the navigation data from the aircraft would also be plugged into it, so you had a complete record of where you'd been and what the magnetic profiles were. And you could also read it back on, after a run, so you make sure you had the data that you expected to have. So, yeah.
Did that mean you had to be in the plane with this machine?
I did for the first season because that was sensible. And the second season would have been, but certainly for the first season, I went down to sort of test, make sure it did work in the field properly as expected. We had to, electronics in the atmosphere in the Antarctic is a bit of a problem because of the temperature. Mm. Yeah, and so you have to. You have to be a bit canny about how you do your electronics down there. So I wanted to go down and make sure, although we tested it in a fridge back here, I wanted to make sure it worked.
You stuck it in a domestic fridge, did you?
Well, no, not a domestic fridge, but the Bass had a huge walk-in freezer, which they used to keep ice core samples and things in. So we used to set the equipment up in there and go in there and make sure it all ran properly. But even so, it was nothing like sticking it in the aircraft under those conditions and running it and operating. And it was fine the first season. We got a good amount of data. The second season I went down to do it, which was, I went down first in 1979-80, and then I went down in 81-82 season. And in 82, it would have been early 82, what happened is the aircraft got blown over by some freak winds, basically, on the airstrip. They tore out the stays and everything. The aircraft was landing up on their back with their legs in the air. So that was the end of the flying season. It wasn't going to be a flying season. I hadn't even got to base. I was still stuck at the transit place at Damoy, waiting to be picked up by these airplanes that were lying on their backs. So we were stuck there, me and a couple of other chaps. And so we eventually got fished out by the John Bisker, who was going to go on the offshore biological program. So they thought, well, we'll make use of Jim because he's electronics bloke. We can do with an extra hand on the ship with all the OBP equipment, which again was Bass Micro based. So I went and helped on that for 3 or 4 weeks.
Just elaborate on OBP for me.
OBP, offshore biological program.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was, basically they were examining krill swarms and I didn't ask a biologist what they did, but they were trawling and looking for krill, and we were doing salinity, temperature, depth measurements with the probe, which was lowered off the ship, and all the equipment was recording that. So I went and helped on that. I mean, helped the guys that were already doing it. It just meant because it was quite long shifts, quite difficult shifts. So an extra hand actually helps the ship system. So, yeah.
How was it interdisciplinary communication? Because It's a very specialist world. You use lots of words I don't fully appreciate.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's perfectly entitled. But the biologists will also be using lots of words that you don't appreciate.
Absolutely, so, yes.
Could nations speak peace into nation? How do you get over those?
I think the answer is we educated each other in the bar.
In the bar?
Probably, yes. I suppose you pick up each other's jargon. You say, "What's that? What's that?" I mean, FIDs have a completely different jargon to the rest of mankind, anyway.
Such as?
Well, you know, like pass the splode. Well, who knows what a splode is? meals are known as scratch, you know, and things like this. You know, it's a language which, even for the word FIDs itself, you know, not many people. What the hell's a FID? You know. It's like all walks of life. There's cliques. You probably find the same in the services. You know, there's words for things that Joe Public doesn't know. You know, but it makes you. I guess it gives you an identity in a way, doesn't it? Having your own language.
Yes, a certain amount of power.
Yeah, a certain amount of power. Yeah, but even amongst yourselves, you know.
What we're talking about here, though, is not just the occasional word, which you can look up in a FID dictionary.
Yeah.
We're talking about different ways of thinking about life, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So were there, did you come across any problems in crossing those disciplines?
I don't remember any, is the answer. I don't remember any. No, I don't think so. I mean, I suppose the only thing that might be difficult is people have a different sense of urgency for different problems, you know. One man's urgency is another man's, I'll wait till tomorrow. But, no, I don't, not really, no. It's a wonderful working atmosphere with FIDs. I think it is.
I mean, this modern day and age, if anything goes wrong with a computer, it's urgent.
Well, yes, in those days, it's your lifeline today, isn't it?
Yeah, in those days it was less so, I guess.
Yeah, less so, yeah. I don't know, actually. That's probably not true.
People depend upon it.
Because, you know, if a programme on our ship is being held up because of a computer fault, you know, because the programme can't operate without the computer, then yes, it is urgent. But all urgency is relative, isn't it? You know, maybe you can go off and do something else in that time, while the equipment's being fixed by the technician. But I mean, things go wrong, obviously, but not always.
There was a change of culture also when NERC swallowed Bass. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I think you have some views on this.
Well, I do, really, because I think it destroyed the Bass that I knew and loved, if you know what I mean. I suppose it would be unfair for me to say that it's better or worse as an organisation, because you don't know what would have happened if it hadn't done. Maybe Bass would have fallen by the wayside because it just didn't have the big support structure. But I certainly found, and I resented, and I think I'm probably not the only one who resented the fact that a decision I was making on purely technical grounds could be overruled by someone who was making this decision on purely financial grounds. And I found that a bit irritating. It's the way of the world these days, I'm afraid. But when you want to buy a piece of equipment, you have to write a specification for this piece of equipment. And say, for instance, it's an oscilloscope. You want to buy this oscilloscope to do this particular job. And so you write a specification, and that goes out to, I don't know, three or four manufacturers of oscilloscopes, and they all put in their bid, and then the finance officer says, "Oh yes, well that one, they all meet the spec, but that one's the cheapest, so we buy that one." That's fine, but as a technical engineer, you look at it and you think, "Oh yes, they all meet the spec. This one is that. That's fine, but this one, which is maybe the second most expensive, actually, that'll do what I want to do next year." And I won't have to buy another one for next year because I can buy that one now. And the finance officer say, no, because it meets the spec that you wrote. And you think, what a waste of money, because next year you've got to go out and buy the other one now. Yeah. And so that sort of flexibility I found didn't exist, and I found it quite frustrating.
Was that actually at the time when Nurkse took over, or was it already creeping into Bass before that? Because the other threshold was when Fuchs stepped down and Dick Laws took over.
Oh, well, that happened just as I joined Bass. When I joined Bass, Dick Laws had just become director. I don't know is the answer. There's all sorts of thresholds throughout the history of any organisation, aren't there? It certainly became more and more apparent at Cambridge. When I came back from down south the first time, Bass had only just moved to Cambridge. And I think it's when Bass became a solid organisation which was all together under one roof instead of dispersed around various universities and research institutes around the country.
The little kingdoms became an empire, didn't they?
They did, yeah. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think that was probably quite a good thing in some ways. But I think that's when the beginning of the Rotstedt, and then of course Nurkse, which was a big administrative body, came in, and little things like, for instance, people would come in to work because the traditional FID, the traditional Antarctic Survey employee, would put the job first and they'd work all hours of the day to get it done because it was, A, it was their ethos to do that, and B, it was their passion. They enjoyed it, they loved it, and they, and you start getting people from a higher administrative structure, and I won't mention any names, who start saying, well, hang on a minute, I'm seeing people that are leaving at 4:30. But these guys have been there since 7 in the morning and they've done what they've got to do. And so they start complaining about people going early or not being there at a certain time, even though these people are on average putting in a lot of time. It's their passion. And so we think, oh, well, we'll have a flexi time system then. So flexi time system comes in where everybody only does 35 hours a week, less work gets done, and trust is gone. Mm. Yeah, trust is gone. And little things like that gradually erode the organisation, I think so.
How fed up did it make you?
Well, it made me fed up enough to leave in the end, yeah. I reluctantly left Bass. I couldn't actually see, and again, because of the civil service rules and regulations, I couldn't see a clear career structure for me there beyond where I got. And I thought, I've been here before, I was there. That was when I was at Rolls Royce. I can see I'm not going to go much further than this. I can see what's going to happen in the future, and I'm going to spend the next 40 years pushing a bit of paper around supporting an aircraft project. Yeah. I don't want to do that, that's why looked for the job and got to Bass, and I could see that happening at Bass, that I wasn't actually sure where it was going to go from there on, and I was beginning to get frustrated by this system that I wasn't wholly happy with, civil service system, and that's it. I said, no, I'll look round, and I went out my own way then. And
did you find a promised land?
Yeah, well, I'm there now. I went into a company in Cambridge initially just to get a bit of a feel for the commercial world, to find out what it was like out there in the real world, in industry, to see what works and what doesn't. And so I joined a company called Cambridge Medical Equipments to design a new type of ECG machine as an engineer, electronics engineer. And that was fine. We produced a good product. I was there for about 18 months, I think. But I found out how not to run a business. I found out exactly how not to run a business. And the way not to run a business is to start a business, think you're an entrepreneur, spend all your money on BMWs without a product. So that's not the way to run a business. So anyhow, that was one of the things I found out. But then I started on my own manufacturing parts for meteorological equipment for a company in Cambridge, Vaisala, which is also, I mean, I was lucky in a way because there was another ex-FID who worked for them. And he was able to sort of feed me a bit of work. And then we got a contract to do a job for Bass, which was do all the data monitoring for the structure of the new Halley 5, old now, of course it's gone, but Halley 5 station. And that involved putting a lot of sensors around the base to measure its movement and performance, really. Load cells under the legs and strain gauges on the cables and all this sort of thing to see how the building performed as a building. And that was a very good contract to get from Bass, and I'm sure we won it because me and my partner at the time had both worked for Bass, and we both knew people there. And I'm sure we got it on merits rather than on old boy network. But
were you down at Halley doing this work yourself?
No. I didn't go to Halley to do it. We built all the equipment here, manufactured it, and delivered it to Bass, and they installed it with their own people, to our instructions, really. Huge number of manuals. But it was a very good contract, and that sort of sealed me then and said, right, now you can actually make it on your own. And my partner, he decided to go back into paid employment, and I carried on my own. And
the other virus that's sweeping through organisations these days is political correctness.
Yes.
I wonder whether you feel that Bass ever had to cope with all that.
Well, I think it did.
There
was undoubtedly
the decision to send women south for a start.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to move with the times. I don't think it's wrong. I don't think that's wrong. I think women, there's nothing wrong with women as scientists, at all. I don't know what the base dynamics would be like now. I dread to think what they'd be like now in isolation. I think it would be very hard. And it could be quite tense. Certainly if it was 2-year periods, I'm not sure they do 2-year periods now, they probably just do 18-month periods, but the bases are different places too. The bases are all much more luxurious, they're more like hotels than they are the bases that we knew, which were basically huts with a toilet bucket, it went into the hut, so it's, the whole thing's changed, and technology's taken over, and then they're much more suitable for mixed, mixed clientele, shall we say. But no, I mean, in terms of science and all that sort of stuff, no, I don't think so. Anything problem having women on bases. I don't see that as being doing it for political correctness. I see a lot of the green issues as being for political correctness.
How do you mean?
Well, silly things like not bury your rubbish on site. For instance, you take a place like Halley, if you had a load of tins and whatever from the base food store, stick it in a big hole in the snow, and, 3,000 years later, it pops out at the bottom. And I can't see it can cause a lot of harm to anybody. And the same with feces and all this sort of thing. But now you ship it out, and it adds extra tonnage to the ship which is taken out, which means it burns more oil. And then you dump it in somebody else's backyard. And I think, personally, I think that's a sort of false. It's being seen to be green, but I think it's false greenness. I think it's, again, that's for political reasons. I think rather than just plain common sense.
Well, it's part of a treaty, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And but, you can't opt out.
No, you can't. That's quite right. And But treaties are generally put together by committees, and you know, I think you have to. It's a question of one rule for a free one, one for all. But they take away the element of common sense. Really, I think so. Anyway.
What made you laugh down there? Were there funny, ridiculous incidents?
Well, I mean, lots of things make you laugh. It's the thing. It's the funny things people do, isn't it? That made me laugh. We had one chap who was determined to find a use for a 45-gallon oil drum. And it's always been one of my ambitions as well, actually, to write a book about the number of uses you can put a 45-gallon oil drum to. But obviously down there they're plentiful because of all the aircraft fuel and all the fuel used to come in oil drums. And so we had these oil drums, and this guy decided one day that he reckoned he could shatter an iceberg with a short 45-gallon oil drum. So how's that going to work? So he says, well, all you've got to do is get the resonant frequency of the iceberg, and it'll shake itself to death. And so he built what we called the Doom Machine on base. And the Doom Machine was a 45-gallon oil drum with a piston in it, which was just a piece of wood. And at the bottom of the drum was a... Yeah, the front of it was open like a cannon, and the end of it was a crank driven by an electric motor. And the idea was to get this piston going in and out to create a pressure wave at the frequency, which was the resonant frequency of an iceberg. So we all he set this thing up and waited for an unsuspecting iceberg to drift past the end of the jetty on the base. And we all went down here with our cans of beer and gins and tonics and snacks and nibbles and... So, right, set off the Doom Machine. All these sounds, Doom Machine off. And play with the speed and play with everything. And we watched this iceberg go slowly past without a single effect on it. And it all went into base and carried on the drinking session. Little things like that were just such fun. Yeah, such fun. Yeah, Simon the Doom Machine. I think he gave up after that and tried to make a desalinator out of oil drums, but it didn't work either.
Has he cracked the oil drum yet?
No, I don't think so. I haven't been in touch with him since we left, so I don't know. Maybe he's still working on it.
It's been lovely, Jim. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Thank you.